joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. With bipartisan support, the Senate Finance Committee voted no on two different amendments that would have added a government-run insurance plan to health insurance reform legislation. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said this proposal will be included in the final House version. Joining me to talk about congressional health care overhaul efforts, Susan Dentzer. She's editor-in-chief of Health Affairs and on-air analyst on health issues with the NewsHour. Julie Robner is health policy correspondent for National Public Radio and contributing editor for National Journal's Congress Daily. And Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. I know how many of you are interested in this whole discussion. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, you busy women.
Good morning, Diane.
It's been quite a time for you. Susan, committee chair Max Baucus said he had to vote against a public plan. Why?
Senator Baucus has said on a number of occasions, Diane, that he doesn't think a public plan will survive a final bill and certainly is not the route to getting 60 votes in the Senate, which is the margin needed to cut off a filibuster and therefore affect the effective margin of control in the Senate. So as much as he has said, as he said again yesterday, there's some very attractive features of a public plan. He just thinks it's politically impossible and therefore doesn't want to bog down the process any more than it's already been bogged down by keeping that on the table.
Julie Robner, is the public option dead?
Oh, absolutely not. There is no question that this is so not the end of the public plan. The senators who offered the amendments yesterday, Jay Rockefeller from West Virginia, Chuck Schumer from New York, both said that they will have this up again on the Senate floor when it goes to the floor for debate. And if it does not prevail there, which is also a distinct possibility, we will indeed certainly see it in conference when there's a House bill and a Senate bill. As you mentioned at the top, this will certainly in some form come out of the House. So it will be a viable issue when there is a House-Senate conference on this. So there's a long, long way to go. The fact that this did not prevail in committee does not by any means mean that there is not going to be a public plan at the end of this process.
Mary Agnes, how do you see it?
Well, to bolster Julie's point, yesterday Chuck Schumer and Senator Rockefeller both in a news conference after the vote said they're reaching out to their moderate colleagues in the Democratic Party. Many of them are open to this. Separately, Tom Harkin, who's head of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which also passed its version of health reform, which does include a public option, said that he thinks this has 50 votes on the Senate floor. It's not the 60 that Susan mentioned, but the proponents of this feel that it absolutely is not over, and they're going to continue to work to build support, and we'll hear about it again for sure on the Senate floor.
Now, listen to the people. Listen to what they are saying as to what they want and the extent to which they feel they have not been represented in these public debates. Susan.
Well, it certainly is the case that the polls seem to suggest the majority of Americans would prefer a public plan, but we have to say that is much more prevalent among Democrats than it is among Republicans. I also think it's important to point out, though, that we don't really still know what the public plan option is. It's a moving target, even in the House of Representatives, where there was one version in the so-called Tri-Committee bill, H.R. 3200, that is being rewritten now even as we speak, as people look for different ways to modify the proposal to bring more support on board. So as Julie says, it's not over, and in fact, probably the real devilish details are only now really being dealt with.
But Julie, what about these co-ops, these nonprofit insurance co-ops that Max Baucus has talked about.
Well, that's what's in the bill now, in the Senate
right.
Finance Committee bill. And that certainly looks what's likely to emerge from the Senate Finance Committee bill. But, you know, behind the scenes, there are a number of senators, a number of moderate senators who are looking for alternatives, maybe an alternative to an outright public plan, but also alternatives to these co-ops, because those co-ops don't seem to be garnering a whole lot of enthusiasm. They may not be the great alternative to the public plan. So there's people, I think Tom Carper from Delaware, who voted for one of the public plan amendments but not the other, is looking at the possibility of having maybe some kind of a hybrid. Senator Snow, of course, the Republican who everybody is assuming is going to be the one Republican who may vote for this bill, was talking about a trigger. Maybe if there wasn't enough competition, there would be a public plan down the road. That doesn't seem to be catching on much either. But there are a lot of things that senators are trying to come up with, some creative kind of compromise. The Senate, after all, has always been about compromise.
Except, on the other hand, you have Senator Chuck Grassley calling the government plan predatory, saying if you have anything of a public plan, it would grow and push out the health insurance programs.
Right. That's exactly one of the major criticisms that many Republicans have of the plan. And some moderate Democrats may feel that way, too. There may be not a high threshold to get government more involved in health care when people look at the spending in Medicare or they're worried about spiraling Medicaid costs. They're certainly proponents of both those programs. But this is all about getting to 60 votes. Whether it is a different approach that might be offered by Senator Carper or Maria Cantwell of Washington State wants to give states ability to negotiate with providers. As Susan mentioned, the details are in flux. Do you negotiate with the providers, as Chuck Schumer's amendment would have done, or do you use Medicare rates as a payment level that would have been for at least 2 years in Senator Rockefeller's bill? In the House bill, there are those who believe that paying Medicare rates is the best way to go. We'll keep costs down, but then some providers don't like that. So this debate is moving everywhere. But again, in the Senate, it's all about 60 votes. It looks like a tough haul, but they could still do it.
There has been some criticism that President Obama has not played a strong enough role here, that he has a role to play now. What could it be? How effective, how powerful could he be now, Susan?
Well, of course, the proponents of a public plan want him to come out and say unambiguously that a public plan option must be in the final proposal, whereas the opponents, of course, want him to kiss the public plan goodbye. And in fact, the administration has indeed sent very mixed signals. The most recent signal that the president sent in his speech earlier in September was that a public plan was a means to an end, but not an end in itself. It wasn't the golden calf that we should all fall down and worship for. We should go for what the intent is of the public plan, which is to lower private health insurance premium cost, or at least slow the rate of growth. And I think that is where the administration still is, still open to hearing about other means. But we'll see how that changes, as it may indeed in the weeks ahead.
Julie, what about the Democrats who are opposing this on grounds other than Max Baucus's saying you can't get to 60 votes? What are their concerns?
Well, you know, in some cases, you've got someone like Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas. She's facing an incredibly difficult reelection effort next year. She's in a state where President Obama is not very popular, so she's gonna have to run on her own. And, you know, she's very worried. She comes from a conservative
so
state.
So it's politics
yes,
for
it's
her.
Politics. Well, it's keeping her seat.
Yeah.
it's politics
yeah.
for her. You've got, you know, moderates who are always, you know, looking over their shoulders. Ben Nelson from Nebraska, Mary Landrieu from Louisiana, Evan by from Indiana. Those are
so they're not willing to risk their seats for something the public has said it wants.
Well, what they will say is that the public in their states don't necessarily say they want this. I mean, that's what they will tell you when you go talk to them, that they are representing the public in they're representing their voters, and that they don't feel that their voters necessarily want this. And that's the difficulty for them.
There are also some policy arguments here. Ben Nelson, again of Nebraska, former insurance commissioner, is worried about the disruption this might cause in the employer-based system. that if the government gets involved, if those prices undercut private plans, they may leave the market and not have the same sort of choice that people currently have. This is also a criticism many Republicans have of the plan. So there is worry about the disruption it could cause in the employer-based system.
Help me to understand how much of a role the insurance companies have played in this debate, how heavily their money has been in terms of lobbying, how influential their lobbyists have been. I mean, I think, Julie, when you talk about this in political terms, it really does come down to who's got the clout. And these insurance companies and their lobbyists certainly have clout, Susan.
That is certainly the case, and the insurance industry broadly is obviously very much opposed to a public plan. It also points out that there are many other pieces in the legislation that would regulate insurers to a far greater degree than has ever been the case. For example, in the House bill, there is a requirement that they would have to pay out 85 cents on the dollar of every premium dollar collected. You could essentially, the insurance industry says, look, we're essentially agreeing to the regulations that would turn us into the equivalent of what you think the public plan is going to have, which is much lower administrative costs, much greater pressure to rein in the excess costs of private insurance. So they say, look, we're putting all of this on the table. Why do you need a public plan that, as Mary Agnes says, could potentially drive us out of business?
They also have gotten out in front, the insurance industry, and said, look, if you Congress, require everyone to have health insurance, we'll not exclude anyone based on a pre-existing condition. We'll not look back at with this practice of rescissions and go back and cancel someone's policies when they get sick. But in return, you're talking about 30 million additional new customers for them.
Mary Agnes Carey, she's senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk further and take your calls. Welcome back. We're talking about the fact that the Senate Finance Committee voted no yesterday on two different amendments that would have added a government-run insurance plan to health insurance reform legislation. Here's our first email from Marilyn in Severna Park, Maryland. She says, a CBS New York Times poll shows 65% of Americans believe we should have a public option. A poll of doctors demonstrated a greater than 70% support for a public option. Please ask your panel, who exactly are the senators listening to when they vote against the public option? Susan.
Well, they're clearly listening to insurance companies. They're also listening to many providers, as Mary Agnes said, hospitals in particular. And the issue all comes down to what kinds of rates would the public plan pay to doctors and hospitals? And if it pays Medicare rates, which we have to look overall at what the impact of the Medicare system now is having on hospital financing. Essentially, most hospitals in the country are losing money on Medicare.
Going broke?
Well, not going broke, but they're losing money on Medicare and making it up on payments from private health insurers.
Okay.
So if you bring another actor into the pool that is paying Medicare rates, i.e. the public plan, that pressure on them is only worse. And so they either would respond by shifting rates, shifting costs to the private payers, in which case, for example, we at Health Affairs, we've published every argument on both sides of this issue ever, but we recently published a paper that argued that if you did have a public plan, private insurance premiums could go up for a family of four by as much as $5,000 a year because of this cost shift potential. Now, there's all kinds of argument about whether that would actually happen. And in the end, it all comes down to how do you think hospitals would respond to this new, very serious rate pressure that they would be under? And that is the whole scenario that says, as Mary Agnes says, employment-based insurance starts to fall apart, hospitals start to go bankrupt, private insurance premiums shoot through the roof. And if those things happen, people fear really real destabilization for the system.
All right. Here's an email from Robert in Manlius, New York. He's got four really good questions. No, actually, yeah, four. He says, the critics of the public option have left me confused. Number one, how will the public option be paid for? Julie.
Well, under now, of course, as we point out, a lot of the details are still in flux, but most of the proposals for the public option say that the public option will be self-sustaining. In other words, the premiums themselves will pay for the public option. So when you go and sign up for this, it will look like every other insurance plan that you would have the option of signing up for. That's the option part. You would pay a premium, and that would pay for the insurance, just as you would pay
and
for a private
plan.
And
if you couldn't afford that,
you would get a subsidy, the same way you would get a subsidy for a private plan. And so there would be government help, but there would be government help for your private plan, too. So basically, premiums would support the public option.
Second question, what percent of Americans will end up with the public option? Mary Agnes.
Some estimates that Senator Rockefeller, again, a Democrat from West Virginia, provided yesterday at the Finance Committee, he said that from his from the CBO scoring, you'd have about 8 million people enrolled in the public plan by about 2015, and that could drop to about 6 million over time. So it's not the estimate is that it's not a large number of the uninsured. It's a significant amount, I think about a quarter, but that it wouldn't be a plan that would come in and bump everybody else out of the market.
Yeah, and that's his third question. Would it dwarf the private insurance companies? Julie.
Remember, there's 160 million people right now with employer-provided insurance. We're talking about 6 million of them.
So. And then finally, would the public option operate under the same rules as the private plans?
Yes, under at least the current set of proposals, it would. It would have to be, as Julie said, as they say, actuarially sound. It has to abide by any laws that are on the books in states affecting private health insurance plans, et cetera. And then, of course, it would be subject to all new federal regulations that would be imposed across the board on health insurance plans.
All right. Let's go to the phones. We've got so many callers waiting. First to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Rachel. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I so appreciate your show.
Thank you.
My question is probably oversimplified, but I'm wondering why we haven't heard anything about an option for the government to cover like catastrophic type of insurance. I feel like that would reduce the cost of, you know, if you wanted to get additional insurance, but it would really take the load off of people like myself who is young and healthy but really can't afford to buy my own health insurance.
In fact, in the Senate Finance Committee plan, there is just that for young people. I think it's called the Young Invincibles Plan. Although there's a concern about that, that if the young people go and buy just this catastrophic insurance, it would make it much less expensive for them to buy just this catastrophic insurance. The problem is then those young, healthy people will not be subsidizing the older people. So it will be harder to bring down the costs for those older people. Also, there was just an amendment suggested that was proposed last night. What happens if a young, healthy woman buys this catastrophic plan and then, lo and behold, gets pregnant? And she doesn't have coverage for prenatal care. She's only got a catastrophic plan. So there's a worry about that. They're trying to figure out what would happen. For instance, the next open enrollment wouldn't come for another 7 months. At that point, she'd be 7 months pregnant. So there are issues with having just catastrophic plans for young, healthy people.
Mary Agnes.
There's also been discussion at the Finance Committee that for some of these catastrophic plans, people don't necessarily understand them, and they're not covered. The coverage is not there when they need them. And is this a way to give credible coverage to people to get them coverage when they need it, which, of course, is something that everyone agrees would help reduce health care costs over time?
Here's an email from Clay, who's in Miami, Florida. I'm going to cover up his language just a little bit. He said, I heard Max Baucus say he voted against the public option amendments yesterday because, quote, no one's shown me a plan which will garner 60 votes. Well, darn it, it doesn't take 60 votes to pass. It only takes 51 votes. It takes 60 to break a filibuster. So what the Democrats are doing is, in effect, crediting the GOP with a freebie filibuster with zero political cost to them. What is with that noise, he says. Pass the public option out of committee and make the GOP filibuster against it. I don't think they would dare to do it. Democrats have already begun to act as though avoiding a filibuster is their main goal, not accomplishing something.
Well, the important point is he's right on one level. It does take 60 votes to cut off filibuster, but you could then pass the underlying piece of legislation with just 51 votes. The problem is that people almost never vote one way on a filibuster and a different way on the bill, so that you would have to get 60 people probably who are really convinced that they liked the bill and were prepared to vote for it later. Now, there has been talk about some deal that maybe some Democrats would say, look, I'll quietly vote for the, or not quietly because everything is on the record, but I'll vote for this to cut off a filibuster, but I'll vote against it on passage. But that almost never happens, so it's a kind of an implausible scenario.
All right, let's go to Dallas, Texas. Leslie, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you
for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really concerned about not having a public option, and my concern is that insurance companies are already starting to raise their premiums kind of in anticipation of having to insure already sick customers once everything passes. But what I'm worried about is, and I'm hoping if someone can tell me this just as specific as it's possible now, what kind of help will be available for people like me who are going to have to drop our insurance as soon as these premiums start raising?
Mary Agnes.
Depends on your income level, because the House plan would have subsidies that could help you if you earn up to about 400% of the poverty level.
Which is,
I believe, about $88,000 for a family of four.
Leslie, are you in that category?
No, I make well less than that.
Okay, so
I make $25,000.
Well, then you're going to qualify because you're below that income
She's
threshold.
She's going to qualify and explain what she will get.
She will get assistance from the government based on her income to help her pick the health plan she wants if it offered through the health plan exchange, which are going to be set up statewide across the country. Public option, if it becomes law, would be one of those choices. But that assistance would help you purchase coverage in the exchange.
Would it be like a tax break? Or would it be actual money to go towards something?
It would be a tax credit. It's called a refundable one, so that if you have very low income, you actually get cash from the government, in effect. It would also be advanceable. You'd get it ahead of time, not after you've already paid it out a year later when you file your tax returns. So there would be a real effort, apparently, to actually make that money as useful as possible to the people who needed it.
Is there a foundation to Grassley's belief that a public option would actually put the insurance companies out of business? Susan?
Well, it all depends on the scenario. As we've said, if in fact what ended up happening was that costs by providers, hospitals and doctors, ended up getting shifted more and more to the private sector. Private insurance premiums went way, way up, as our caller just said. People dropped out of that coverage because they couldn't afford it, found themselves unable to meet the individual mandate provision, just was unaffordable. Yes, you could see the whole system fall apart, but it all depends on what happens, and that's what we just don't know.
Now, there's a piece of this that's not supposed to happen. The idea that the quid pro quo for the insurance companies having to cover all these sick people is that they get all these new people in
right.
the pool. So the idea is that the new people in the pool, those premiums are supposed to make up for the sick people. So they're not supposed to have to raise the premiums. The premiums should stay stable because of all the new healthy people who are paying in.
All right. Let's go to Mary in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I think that your last caller just proved a point that the insurance companies are not to be trusted. And I think that if no public plan is offered, that it's just going to be a windfall for the insurance companies. And I don't think that in the past they've shown that they have anything but profits as their main motive. And I wonder if your panel can remind me that I thought in the past that insurance companies kind of said they'd get their house in order and, you know, help some of these people without insurance, and it just doesn't happen. They are not to be trusted.
Mary Agnes.
She's almost quoting Jay Rockefeller, again, a Democrat from West Virginia, Senator, verbatim from yesterday. He kept saying, we can't trust this industry. They don't do the right thing. The public health option would guarantee that people have a choice of something they can't afford, and you'd have a competitor to the private insurance industry that doesn't have a profit motive, that would have lower administrative costs, and would provide people a choice.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To what extent are members of Congress hearing from constituents? Mary Agnes.
Well, let's not forget about August. It's not that far off. We had town hall meetings. Some constituents complained very loudly, pro-public option, against a health reform bill, period. I think that all those, that sort of feedback from constituents is only going to increase this fall because people are really now beginning to focus on this.
And the phrase that they're hearing from the opponents of the public plan is Trojan horse for single-payer system. This is a way to get a public plan established that eventually could produce the so-called government takeover of healthcare. And that clearly is an argument that resonates for many people.
And the phrase government takeover is in and of itself a negative phrase.
For as we know, the country divides up into people who think of government as us and the people who think of government as them or they. So for many people, that's a frightening prospect. For others, it's a comforting prospect. For people who look at Medicare and say Medicare's been a terrific boon to senior citizens and the disabled, why not extend those same protections to other individuals?
You know, the public plan is really a very small piece of this entire effort. But what it's really done is it's crystallized this debate about people who, on the one hand, don't trust the government and people who, on the other hand, don't trust private insurance.
But wasn't that what the election was about? People who trusted Obama's vision of the future and those who didn't.
Yes, but as we see now, we're not quite clear on what the president's vision currently is
exactly.
Vis-a-vis the public plan.
Now, what would happen if there were no insurance companies? Mary Agnes.
Well, it would depend, I guess, then it would depend what the government wanted to do with that. Would you take the Medicare program and increase it to allow people to buy into that. Would you increase Medicaid eligibility? That's certainly a provision that's in the House and the Senate bills. It would be a very different world, very, very different from the one we have now for health coverage.
Why do we need the insurance companies, Julie?
Well, the question is, the insurance industry will say that they provide a value added, that they do things like coordinating care, and disease management. They do actually do things that Medicare doesn't do. Medicare is just sort of a Wild West fee-for-service. That's how it's described. That there are things that the private insurance industry has pioneered, and in some cases Medicare has then adopted, so that they say that they actually do things. And there are certainly elements of the insurance industry, and there are parts. Remember, there's a for-profit part of the insurance industry and a nonprofit part of the insurance industry. So you can't really lump the insurance industry all together as one.
It's also the case that the leadership in the insurance industry wants to be in a different kind of a business, a modified business. Their old business was basically segmenting risks, figuring out who were the dangerous people who would become sick and not covering them. And they say now they want to be in the management of health expenses business. They want to get everybody in the pool and then help to manage the cost.
But then you come back to Senator Rockefeller's statement. What is the evidence that this time it's going to be different? Mary Agnes?
He believes it won't be different. And that the public plan will, as many Democrats and President Obama have said, will keep the health insurance industry honest. You need the check and balance of a public plan to make the health insurers do what they say, as Susan describes, they want to do.
And yet the president, who has friends who are CEOs of some of these companies, hear them say, look at our track record. Look at what we've managed to do to restrain costs so far. Look at what we're doing to help manage the costs of end-of-life care. As Julie says, all of these value-added tools that we bring that Medicare doesn't even utilize to manage costs.
You know, years and years ago, I was a health reporter following Joe Califano around. These same arguments were being made back then. Extraordinary. We'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls and your comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by Families USA, working for high-quality, affordable health care for everyone, and collecting personal health care stories at familiesusa.org. This is NPR.
The September Reader's Review, Maurice Sendak's classic, Where the Wild Things Are, a discussion of the beloved children's tale about Max, monsters, and making mischief of one kind or another. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And as we talk about health insurance and overhaul of the health plan, there's some talk of a possible compromise to allow for a public plan in states where people could not find affordable coverage. What are the prospects there, Susan?
Well, as we said earlier, Senator Snow has suggested that that might be one possibility, although, as has been pointed out, it doesn't seem to be picking up a lot of support. Another potential compromise would just throw all of this at the states and say if the states vote to have a public plan, they can have a public plan, and then you would fight the battle out on a state-by-state basis.
What a mess that would be if you moved around. Julie, tell me about these so-called Cadillac tax plans, Cadillac insurance plans, Cadillac health coverage plans.
Well, the idea, and this is one of the ways that the Senate finance bill would be paid for, is to tax the most generous health plans. And the idea is that those plans have very generous benefits, and they cost a lot of money. And this is the way it works now is that the insurance companies would be taxed on those plans. But the idea is that that tax would be then passed along to the employer and in turn to the employee.
But, you know, it's not just through employers that these Cadillac plans operate. I have a dear friend who told me she paid $1,500 up front, and that allows her access to her doctor whenever she wants. And then she pays over and above. It's called
a concierge plan.
Yes.
I don't believe those. I think this would only apply to employer-provided plans.
And to insurance. And what she has is not an insurance arrangement, it sounds like.
No, it's not just through the employer. It's a plan.
No, her plan. But I'm saying I think the Finance Committee would only tax
the employer-provided plans.
And the idea is that they would deter these plans from being provided. The problem with that, though, is that in some cases these very expensive plans aren't necessarily that expensive because they're so generous. Sometimes they're that expensive because they're located in very expensive parts of the country, places where it's simply that expensive to provide insurance, or they're very expensive because they happen to be a small employer with several sick employees. So they are trying to create a phase in. For instance, I think they have the 17 most expensive states would be phased in more slowly, and they're trying to figure out ways so that it wouldn't hit people accidentally. And that's turning out to be a little bit complicated.
Mary Agnes,
another difficulty with this is that there are many unionized workers that may fall into this threshold of plans that would face the excise tax, and in many cases, these folks have taken a lower pay increase to keep their health insurance.
Have that.
Exactly.
Yeah. What kind of polling is there on these, Julie?
Well, we just released a poll this morning. This is an NPR, Kaiser Family Foundation, Harvard School of Public Health poll, and we actually asked people what they thought about the involvement of healthcare interest groups in the debate, and it was interesting because we've been talking about the insurance industry and all the healthcare lobbyists. What was interesting that we found was that the public was pretty well split. Rather than thinking that, you know, it's bad for lobbyists to be involved in writing these bills, they thought that about half of the public thought that it was, you know, that interest groups are, you know, too involved and have, you know, too many of their own worries to be involved in this. But about half of the public thought that, no, these interest groups really have something valuable to provide and ought to be at the table. Now, of course, of those, they trust doctor and nurse groups the most and insurance and pharmaceutical groups the least. But what the real striking finding, and this was not something we went out looking for and expected to find, was that 71% of those polled thought that Congress was not paying attention to the needs of people like them.
Exactly. Exactly. Here's an email going back to an earlier discussion of one of our callers or emailers who made the point that Republicans should be forced to actually do the filibuster. At least then they would have to suffer the political consequences of that action. Right now, they're getting the benefit of the filibuster without the consequences.
Well, that may indeed be the way it plays out, although, as we've said, it looks pretty clear now that the Senate, certainly what comes out of the Senate Finance Committee, won't have a public plan option in it. It's very hard to believe that there would be a robust public plan option in the final Senate bill. It just seems as if that would sail the whole thing into a Bermuda Triangle in the Senate. And, of course, the goal is to get bills out onto the floor and get them passed, get to conference committee, as Julie said, and then have a final bill. If you don't keep that process moving, it doesn't happen, and the public plan could be the ultimate roadblock, at least in the Senate.
Republicans could also face the music, if you will, by just voting against the bill. I mean, you can go the filibuster route, and you can go through all that and burn up time on the Senate floor. But again, it burns up time. Here we are at the end of September, almost beginning of October. They want to do the bill this year. And if, in fact, Democrats prevail, pass a bill, and it's signed into law, that's a strong weapon for them in next year's midterm elections to say to voters, Republicans were against us, whether it's that they forced a filibuster or they voted against the bill.
All right, to Melinda, who is in Columbia, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I want to make several points. One is that which has been done before, that the insurance companies are for-profit organizations, so they will always be more expensive. I have just been reading T.R. Reid's book on Healing on America. He compares the different systems in the world of the health care, and particularly the French, which is the number one best health care in the world, as according to the World Health Organization. And what they do, they do have insurance. It's mostly private insurances, but they're non-for-profit. Don't forget, the insurance companies still have the automobile and the house insurance that they can make money on. But health care is a right for everyone, and everyone should afford it. And they have, I think, 100 different types of insurance plans.
All right.
Choice. And I highly recommend that book, which we should adopt. They have a health card that goes with them. They don't have charts anymore. Everyone has a health card, and when they go to the doctor, they just show the health card.
Sounds attractive, Susan.
Well, there are, as the caller says, a number of countries that do have universal systems that are based on single-payer type systems, but there also are a large number that have hybrid systems like ours. Japan, Australia, Switzerland, the Netherlands, they all have a mix of public and private coverage, and they manage to cover virtually everybody in the population. So it isn't utterly clear that the only way you can get to universal coverage is to exclude private insurance. In fact, there are many countries that are doing it. And for better or for worse, this is the system that we have in the U.S. We have about 50% of all health expenditures paid for through public health insurance, and the rest is paid for through private.
All right. To Casper, he's here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Morning, Diane. How are you guys doing today? I wanted to call in because to provide a dissenting voice. I'm one of those people who doesn't want the public option. I've, for several reasons, not the least of which, and I've heard people saying they want to, I've heard congressmen saying that they want the public option so it will compete with the private groups. Well, we have a recent example of where that doesn't work so well. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae competed with other mortgage groups, but because they had the implicit guarantee of the government, which turned out to be not so implicit, they were able to get better rates and could not, and so the other people really couldn't compete against them.
Well, that is certainly the case in that sector. There isn't anything purely analogous to that in the public plan approach. And, of course, as we've said, the idea of the public plan today is that it would have to be self-sustaining, that it would get no subsidies. The fear on the other hand, as we've said, the fear on the other hand is, okay, so you set up a public plan, you create generous benefits. Let's say 1 year it doesn't quite have enough premium dollars to cover outlays, so the government kicks in a couple of billion, and then the next year and the next year. And that is what the people who are afraid of the public option as a so-called Trojan horse are afraid about.
Well, I mean, that's already happening with I believe, Medicare. It's currently, they think the current CBO projection is going to go broke in 2013.
Yeah, well, Medicare is not an insurance plan. It's a bill-paying operation for health care expenditure. So there's never been any pretense that Medicare would pay its own way in terms of funding itself off of premiums. It's funded largely, to some degree, by premiums, but largely by taxpayers.
Julie, this argument goes so far back, it's unbelievable.
Yes, I was doing some research for a story, and I found, you know, I found these kinds of arguments about government involvement in healthcare going back to 1915. So this is when, you know, there were arguments about, does the United States want to be like Germany? Remember, the Germans put in their national health system in the late 1800s. So it really does go all the way back. When President Obama says, you know, talks about we've been having this debate for more than 100 years, he means we've been having this debate for more than 100 years and with many of the same arguments.
Mary Agnes.
And we'll continue to have this debate. Whether or not Congress passes a bill this year is unclear. Whether or not it will be the size of the current packages is extremely unclear. You could have something passed that's fairly scaled back from what they have to get the 60 votes in the Senate. And then members will certainly revisit it, even if the package, a more comprehensive package, is passed. This debate will continue for years and years and years because health care is such a big part of our economy and means so much to people's lives.
Let's go now to Little Rock, Arkansas. Rhonda, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. You know, the health insurance companies say that they regulate and coordinate your coverage and your diseases and everything. Well, I would just as soon have my doctor do that. And I'll give you an example. I changed jobs about 2 months ago, and I've been on the same medication for about 5 years. Well, when I changed the insurance company, this insurance company decided that the medication that I was on wasn't one that they covered because I guess it was too expensive. So every one of my medications had to be changed just simply based on what they would or would not cover, not based on anything that my doctor had thought I needed for 5 years. So I'm now on all new medications.
And how are you feeling, Rhonda?
Well, so far I feel fine, it's just the principle of
sure.
It that some pencil pusher is deciding what I should or shouldn't take.
Well, and so,
just based on the type of medicine.
It's a really interesting point, Susan.
It is, but it's also the case that in many instances, people are taking brand name drugs when they could take generic medications. And one big push of all payers in recent years has been to nudge people onto generic medications at enormous cost savings. So the question would be, is that what happened in your case? In which case, probably it's not only saving you money, it's probably saving society money.
Is that what happened, Rhonda, where you simply switched to generic drugs?
I think one of them was a generic drug, but like one of them was a migraine medicine because I have to take like a daily migraine medication
right.
And then a PRN medication.
Right.
And like, say if there's 10 different types of migraine medicines, they only cover one. And so the one that I had found that worked best for me was a drug called Zomig. And then they have decided, I don't even know what the other one is called. It's Cymbalta or something.
Yeah. But what she is saying is that in this case, not her doctor, but the insurance company is deciding which drug she's going to
take.
Well,
often that's a matter of insurance companies will get a deal with the drug makers. And it's not even really the insurance company. It's the company that the insurance company subcontracts with that gets the deal with the drug maker that says, we'll put all of our people on this drug and then we'll get a better price. So it really is. I mean, that is one way of holding down costs, but that's not what I was talking about really when I was talking about the managing, you know, some of the ways that insurance companies do manage people's care, but that is one way that they do try to hold down costs.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Mary Agnes.
I think the overall point here is this is the kind of practice that drives people nuts. They just want to get their health care. It's enough to get the doctor's appointment. It's enough to get in to see the doctor. Then the doctor writes the script. Then you go to the drugstore and you want to get it filled and you find out it's not on, as Julie described, the formulary. And I know that they do want to control costs by tiering prices. A generic would be least expensive, and then depending on the brand name, it's more expensive. But if it's not covered at all, then it's totally out of your pocket.
Do we have any thought that with a government-run health plan or a public option that there would be more emphasis on prevention?
The hope of many backers of the public plan is that it would be an area in which the government could do a lot to experiment, not just on areas like covering prevention, but also more broadly by paying doctors very differently, all kinds of ways to restructure the healthcare delivery system. But prevention is catching on even more broadly than that. In fact, there are provisions in the bills now that would require even people enrolled in private insurance plans through the new insurance exchanges would be some of the preventive services would have to be covered with no cost sharing to the beneficiary.
You're talking about exercise. You're talking about...
Well, not exercise, but certainly the kinds of things, screening in particular, mammography, colonoscopy.
But, you know, it goes back farther, doesn't it? I mean, it goes back to how each of us takes care of ourselves. Therefore, exercise programs, diet, nutrition programs, would those be covered, Julie?
Probably not. But one of the hopes is that if we create what are called these medical homes, where there would be doctors and nurses and perhaps nutritionists, and that people would get more time with medical professionals, not necessarily doctors, but trained medical professionals who could counsel people on better lifestyle choices and better nutrition and how to get exercise. It wouldn't necessarily be spending your doctor's time, but it would be doing things, interventions up front that would help keep people healthy.
And all this focus on prevention, it's one of the areas where there's great bipartisan support. You know, we talk a lot about the public option and some of the other more combative elements of the bill, but there's great agreement on many things, including all the things we're talking about on prevention.
Mary Agnes Carey, Julie Rabner, Susan Dentzer, thank you so much for your time, your good work, your explanations. I'll see you again.
Thanks, Diane.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.